From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on September 23rd, 2015, when Pope Francis addressed the U.S. Congress on his visit to the United States. Francis singled out four people as, quote, great Americans. Everyone knew Martin Luther King Jr. and Abraham Lincoln. Not everyone knew Thomas Merton and Dorothy Day. Dorothy Day was the founder of the Catholic Worker Movement and an advocate for the poor. Her newspaper celebrated pacifism and the idea of equality. The Washington Post notes that her paper, quote, promoted the idea of a human family that Pope Francis would take up decades later. The movement spawned hospitality houses around the country that served as refuges for the poor and centers for international living and social justice organizing. In 1955, Day led a protest against civilian drills staged around mock Soviet nuclear attacks. During the Vietnam War. She trumpeted conscientious objection and nonviolent resistance, saying that one way to end this insane war was to pack the jails with our men, end quote. Paul Ellie, a senior fellow in Georgetown's Berkeley Center for Religion, Peace, and World Affairs, notes that Pope Francis called our attention to four figures, three of whom were nonviolent figures out of the four, and three were categorically against violence. Which brings us to today here in Rochester. When you hear the word nonviolence in Rochester, you might immediately think of the Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence. It was founded in 1991 in Memphis by Arun Gandhi, the grandson of M.K. Gandhi, moved to Rochester in 2007. Today, the grandchildren of Gandhi and Dorothy Day are together for an event. But first, they are here on Connections and want to say hello to everyone in studio. Kate Hennessy is here. She is the granddaughter of Dorothy Day and the author of this remarkable portrait of her grandmother. Dorothy Day, the world will be saved by beauty. Kate, great to have you. Thank you for being here.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Martha Hennessy is also the granddaughter of Dorothy Day. Great to have you. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
And here is Arun Gandhi. Nice to have you in studio and nice to see you right here in Rochester again. Thank you so much for being here, Arun.
Thank you for having me on the show.
And our thanks to Harry Murray, who is also in studio with us. He is the director of the Peace and Justice Program at Nazareth College. Harry, welcome to you. And why don't you tell us what's coming up tonight, 7 p.m. at the Schultz Center at Nazareth College. What's coming up?
Well, we're going to have a panel featuring Arun Gandhi and Martha and Kate Hennessy on a discussion on the nonviolent legacies of our grandparents. This came about because St. Joseph's House of Hospitality, which I might note is, in terms of the building, is the oldest Catholic worker house of hospitality in the universe, was talking, folks there were talking with me about bringing Kate and Martha in, and I thought, and I had just read Kate's tremendous biography, and I also knew that Arun was in town, and he had also just published a tremendous book about his grandfather, and I thought, what great synergy. They've never met before, but what great synergy, especially in the era that we're living in, which I won't go on about, to bring these three people together to talk about their grandparents and the legacy of their grandparents, and also the fact that these three are, in many ways, the legacy of their grandparents, because each of them has carried on the nonviolent work of their grandparents in ways that are worth being talked about of themselves.
7 p.m. tonight, and you'd like the entire community to know, 7 p.m. tonight, a discussion on Dorothy Day and M.K. Gandhi, the legacy of our nonviolent grandparents. So our guests will be there this evening at the Schultz Center at Nazareth College, this rare opportunity. And it was just, let me ask Mr. Gandhi, and first I'll start with you. It was just a couple of days ago that the director of the M.K. Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence in Rochester was a guest in this studio as we talked about a subject that I confess I never thought we would have to be talking about, but it's a strange time right now. And the subject was this: should we punch Nazis? And I know it sounds bizarre, but there are viral videos. There are people delighting in street demonstrations that become violent. There are those who are justifying violence against white nationalists, white supremacists, people wearing swastikas on their arms in Boston, in Seattle, in Charlottesville, in Atlanta, across the country. And here we were having this discussion on, you know, what would Gandhi say? How would this be confronted? Is this a strange time for you? Do you feel in some ways that your family's work Do you ever feel any pessimism or darkness when you see these things happening around our country?
Yes, I do. I mean, when I see a lot of the violence that is occurring all over the world and in our country, it is sometimes disheartening. But then I remember my grandfather's words that we just have to continue working and planting seeds of peace. And, you know, he told me when I was living with him as a little boy that you must become a peace farmer. And just like a regular farmer goes out into the fields and plants seeds and hopes and prays that he gets a good crop, in the same way you just continue to plant seeds of peace and hope and pray that eventually you get a good crop of peacemakers. So I take that lesson and continue to do the work that I am doing and planting seeds. But yes, when you see things, it does sometimes make you feel a little disheartened.
And I certainly would only ask you to speak for yourself or maybe to think about what your grandfather might say. But on this program on Wednesday, we heard from listeners who said, I never would think of myself as a violent person or would even think about myself as celebrating violence in any fashion. But when we see Charlottesville, when we see other things happening around this country, you get this urge, this anger, this bewilderment that here we are, it's 2017 and we're debating these things. And sometimes when you feel that despair, they're saying, essentially, I understand the push to violence. They also said this, though, and I'm curious to get your take. Some of our listeners said, is this a time where if we are not forcefully, physically pushing back at times, that we can be putting ourselves in danger, the most vulnerable citizens in danger? And are we reaching that point where nonviolence isn't working anymore? What's the lesson there?
No, I think nonviolence would work under any circumstances if we really understood the philosophy and practiced it thoroughly. Unfortunately, we don't really understand it, and therefore we only look at nonviolence as the opposite of physical violence. And what I learned from my grandfather was that we not only commit physical violence in our daily lives, but we commit a lot of passive violence, which is non-physical, but yet we hurt people emotionally and morally and otherwise through our actions. Like simple things like accepting poverty, accepting all the discrimination and oppression that goes on in our societies, the bad relationships that we have with each other, where we can't get along because of all the diversities we focus on. All of these things are violence too. So to say that I am not violent because I don't go out and fight in the streets is not right. I am violent because I practice a lot of these passive attitudes of violence. And therefore, I think that what my grandfather wanted us to understand is that nonviolence is not just a conflict resolution program. It is about personal transformation. If we don't transform ourselves and transform our thinking and our attitudes and our relationships with each other, we are going to continue to go downhill. And all the strife that we see in our midst right now is because of our bad relationships. One of the things that is happening now is the African-American people are agitating because of the discrimination that they experience all the time. We gave them civil rights by law, and we thought that was the end of everything, everything will take care of itself. The law has enabled them to get equality to some extent, that they can be here with us and be treated as human beings. But no law can ever make a person respect the other person if they don't want to. And that is where we are struck. We tolerate each other, but we don't respect each other. And I don't think tolerance is what we want between people. Because I can tolerate somebody and not necessarily like that person or respect that person. And And, you know, that's a very negative relationship. I got to respect a person. I may not agree with their beliefs and their attitudes there, but as a human being, I respect that person.
So that's the difference in too much focus on tolerance as opposed to actually getting beyond tolerance to actual respect.
Exactly. We have not gone beyond tolerance. We just got stuck at tolerance.
Let me turn to Kate and Martha Hennessy. And Kate, I'll start by asking you why you decided to write this book now, Dorothy Day, The World Will Be Saved by Beauty, An Intimate Portrait of My Grandmother. You know, I wonder when you decided to write it. How did it strike you when Pope Francis was invoking her name I think it was just about 2 years ago this week in his visit here? And take me through some of your thought process there in deciding to put this portrait of Dorothy Day out into the world.
Well, it came out after the death of my mother, Tamar, Dorothy's own daughter, only daughter. And I had spent many, many years, my mother and I had really talked a lot about her mother and the enigma that she was, the very complex relationship the two of them had. And when my mother died, I realized that, you know, if my mother's story wasn't told, there would be this essential element of Dorothy Day's story that would not be told, and that is the story of her as a mother, as a woman, as a family person. And really, everything that she did came out of one of the most important moments of her life, which was the birth of my mother. So that was, it was, the book, the subtitle is called An Intimate Portrait of My Grandmother, but it really is of my grandmother and my mother. Mm-hmm. Now, when I started this in 2009, the book was finished by the time Pope Francis gave his talk to the U.S. Congress, but I was at the Catholic Worker in New York City at that time, and I was coming into the dining room. I was late, for they brought the TV into the dining room at Mary House, and I had come in late, and as soon as I sat down, I heard Pope Francis say, "Dorothy Day." And I was so shocked, I almost fell out of my chair. I did not expect that at all. And people said, "Oh, no, this is like the third time that he has mentioned her." I mean, it really was quite extraordinary.
And in those moments, when a lot of Americans are grabbing onto the knowledge about this person, some for the first time, there's, a risk in hagiographing. You know, when we look at someone's life, we want to, particularly when they've passed on, we want to grab on to the wonderful parts of their legacy. And Dorothy Day is going to be remembered forever for that legacy, for what she has created. But there is a little bit of hagiography that comes when anybody has passed on. Well, your portrait creates, I think, a much more real person. You know, and I think it will be surprising for some people who read this book to find out how interesting her own journey was and the people who kind of helped her pivot and see the world in different ways. And, you know, the fact that, you know, she had an abortion, that she went through different relationships. And at times, I think people would look at this and say, wait a second, this is not exactly the hagiographed caricature I have. This is a much more real person. In many ways, doesn't that make it more valuable to find out that someone can accomplish what she did, you know, not being perfect, a saint, even if she does become a saint in her life? Doesn't that make it more valuable?
Of course, absolutely. I mean, I think one of the dangers that we have, and she, you know, herself said this. I mean, she very famously said, "Don't call me a saint. I don't want to be dismissed so easily."
I love that line.
Yeah, and, you know, it's a complicated line. She was complicated. She loved the saints. They were essential to her and to her faith. So she wasn't, you know, dismissing saints. What she was dismissing is our ability to dismiss people whom we think are perfect. And she is saying, "I'm not perfect, and not only am I not perfect, but this is no excuse for you not to do the work that you're meant to do." So it was very clear on her part of she didn't want to be set aside as the perfect saint. And, you know, in terms of saints, the saints are not perfect. They never were. They were very complicated people. And she is, you know, no different than that. And I think what we've done is we've decided to turn saints into these kind of, you know, pious perfection that we can never achieve. And I think that's done us a huge disservice.
The Atlantic Monthly review of the book, I thought, keyed in on some things that also stood out to me. The Atlantic Monthly's review was titled, "A Saint for Difficult People. From Bohemian to Radical to Catholic Activist, Dorothy Day devoted her life to the poor, however unlovable." And I want to read a little bit from that review and get some of your take on that, if I could, Kate. The Atlantic Monthly writes, quote, "Day was about people, especially poor people, especially those whom she called with some wryness the undeserving poor, and the paramount importance of serving them." And the review goes on to say this: "A lot of gas has been spewed recently, green, heavy, showbiz wizard gas, about the overlooked person, the forgotten man. Well, Dorothy Day lived with the forgotten man, and he was a huge pain in the ass. His name was Mr. Breen, and during his residency at the Catholic Worker House on Mott Street, he was a bit vituperative racist and a fire hazard. His name was also Mr. O'Connell, who stayed for 11 ill-natured years at Mary Farm, the Catholic Worker Farming Commune in Easton, Pennsylvania, slandering the other workers without mercy, hoarding the tools, and generally making of himself a terror, in Day's words, and hateful, venomous, suspicious, in Hennessy's. One gets the sense from Hennessy's book and from Day's own writing that she reserved a special respect for these very difficult people, because it was with them so thornily particular that she was obliged to put flesh on all those airy abstractions about justice and generosity. This was, so to speak, where the rubber met the road." End quote. What do you think of that?
Absolutely. That's one thing I learned from my mother, is that, my mother loved Mr. Breen. She loved Mr. O'Connell. I mean, she got along with the most difficult people at the Worker. And that was a real, in some ways, she was actually better at it naturally than her mother. And so it was a real lesson for me when I grew up hearing these stories of these amazing people and difficult people. And to hear the laughter from my mother and the love in her eyes, that was extraordinary. It was very powerful.
I think of this makes me think of many people in positions of privilege, myself included, who, I'm sure I could do more for people in need. But to the extent that I do, if I encounter people who don't seem grateful, who don't seem appreciative of, well, maybe I'm giving a gift of money, maybe it's a gift of time, maybe I'm working in a soup kitchen, whatever it is, it's so easy for us to say, well, they're not grateful, and sort of shut and go back to our daily lives and shut down. And it seemed that Dorothy Day really did feel that if you really want to commit to this, you must commit, and you must understand that you don't always get affection and love in return, and it might not always be this grateful response, but we are called to serve anyway, and that this is a test. Is that a test for us?
Of course, and it's an education. Martha can speak to this better than I, because she spends a lot of time at the Catholic Worker in New York City, but we are pushed to our extremes on how to live with each other, how to accept each other, no matter what our quirks and difficulties. It's the hardest thing.
Martha, next hour we're going to be talking about something called the Theater of War that works with the veteran experience and how families can break down and how, in particular, PTSD can impact people, suicidal ideations, all of the complexity that comes with it and how much struggle there is. And I wonder, when you work with people who, I don't know that to the extent that charity or hospitality feels like we're trying to fix people. I think what we're trying to do is build community and not, quote unquote, fix someone overnight. But how do you view the importance of understanding that we don't necessarily get to just make someone whole again overnight, and that there's going to be abrasiveness and pain and struggle and failures, and that comes with the human experience, and that if we walk away from that, we can justify it however we would like to ourselves, but Dorothy Day didn't really walk away from that, and that the harder thing to do is to stay. How do you view that?
Well, Pope Francis talked about the church needing to become a field hospital, that we need to practice triage in this war. I mean, we're all prisoners of war in one sense or another. And the work at Mary House, as it is with all of the houses of hospitality around the country, it's a daily exercise in coming to grips with our own internal imperialistic urges. When we talk about the undeserving, our culture tells us that if you don't measure up to a certain value in our citizenry, do you earn enough money? Do you participate enough? Are you pulling your own weight? Well, the Catholic worker traditionally ends up with people who fall through all cracks. And yes, we're dealing with post-traumatic stress disorder on a massive cultural level for many different reasons. And I find that working in the houses of hospitality is one way of keeping oneself sane, even though there are many, many moments where you feel driven insane by the demands of the day. But I think of Christ in the agony in the garden where he is saying, please take this cup from me if thou will. Dorothy talked about the great tragedy is that not enough of us want to be saints. And so, yes, the harvest is huge and the laborers are few in terms of the work that must be done to pick up the pieces of our permanent war economy, of our capitalist system that creates human wreckage.
Can I also ask you to kind of tie this into some modern questions on helping those in need? And I don't mean to pick an easy target, but I do want to ask you a question that I think is a serious question. I think sometimes in the American media seems pretty divided in terms of, maybe you would call it partisan or sort of the stereotypical right-left divide. And often on right-leaning media covers Christianity as if it's sort of all Christian right, and pro-life on the right means abortion only, whereas on the left it might mean something much more in line with what the consistent life ethic. So these things are sort of, they get kind of bifurcated. And we see Christianity covered on the right in a very different way. And we see Christ's message covered on the left in a very different way. And yet, some of the biggest churches, some of the biggest movements are run by people who would not open their door until they were sort of forced to after Hurricane Harvey. And I'm looking at the Osteens. And I did find that really troubling. And I know it seems like low-hanging fruit, but does it bother you? Would it bother Dorothy today if we had this conversation, we see how far afield some people seem to be when it comes to Christ's message and how lacking opulence Christ's life was, whether you believe he was the Son of God or not, versus how some people claim Christianity today?
I think Christ was a personalist. You know, just yesterday we had the Feast of St. Matthew. He said to the tax collector, follow me. So he made a direct appeal to those around him to come and do this work. And he says, if you want to enter the kingdom of heaven, you must pick up your cross. We see what we did to Jesus. I want to read something very brief Dorothy wrote in August of 1965, which I think speaks to this. Christ is being martyred today in Vietnam, in Santo Domingo, in all places where men are taking to the sword in this world crisis. He will be crucified to the end of time. He is with us in his humanity until the end of time. And you can replace Vietnam and Santiago with Yemen, Syria, Mexico. Many, many countries are suffering. And so Christ is our brother, and we see our brother in the poor. We are our brother's keeper.
I think of what's going on in Puerto Rico and how many Americans don't even realize those are American citizens and people struggling now. We're just beginning to get those images, and how many of us, and I've got to ask myself the question again, I'm part of this. How many of us are actually going to do anything, whether it's writing a check or calling to check on people or showing our love or volunteering? Just so many great lessons, I think. So I just want to, again, thank Kate for writing the book. The book is Dorothy Day, The World Will Be Saved by Beauty, An Intimate Portrait of My Grandmother. It humanizes Dorothy Day in a way that, again, I think adds so much value and reality to this person that we're hearing much more about. I want to get our only break of the hour. And when we come back, if you'd like to join the program, we'll take some of your questions, comments, phone calls. We're talking to three remarkable people and Harry Murray. So four. Harry, you're remarkable too.
I'm non-remarkable person.
No, three grandchildren of these amazing world figures, Dorothy Day and Mohandas Gandhi. And the event tonight, Dorothy Day and Mohandas Gandhi, The Legacy of Our Nonviolent Grandparents. It is at 7 p.m. tonight at the Schultz Center at Nazareth College. It is open to the public, and they would love to have you there. They're all here, Kate and Martha Hennessy and Arun Gandhi here. So they're my guests in studio for the hour. You want to call the program? It's 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program, connections at WXXI.org. You can find me on social media, Twitter at Evan Dawson or producer Megan Mack at MMack Media. We're right back with some of your comments and them next. Coming up in our second hour, Theater of War is coming to Rochester tonight. It is a story that goes back to 5th century BCE, but ties themes of war, PTSD, stress, and suicide all to modern-day military issues. It's a way for us to communicate better, understand one another better. And we'll tell you the story next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Want to grab an email from James, who writes to the program and says, Evan, thank you for this discussion. My concern is what one of your guests talked about earlier this hour. That is how we misunderstand what nonviolence is and how it works. Too often we think that nonviolence equates to weakness and that strength will always beat weakness. Can your guest talk more about that? Mr. Gandhi, I think that is probably directed at you, and I think that's a great point. So let's talk about how we misunderstand what nonviolent protest and movement means.
Well, I think nonviolence protest really means that we show greater moral strength, whereas the fighting means that we show greater physical strength. And by using physical strength against each other, we don't really convert anybody. We just beat up on the people. And the problem that we are all concerned about remains on the side. What we need to do is all of us come together and try to address the problem and try to resolve the problem there. So nonviolence requires greater moral strength, whereas fighting requires greater physical strength.
But it can still accomplish the goals. I mean, this is important. To James' point in the email, if we just characterize it as violence versus nonviolence or strength versus weakness, then certainly the idea of a nonviolent movement is not going to be as appealing. You have seen its successes over the years, haven't you?
Yes, I have seen it, and it's all over the world. Anybody who wants to make any research on it, they can find many instances of nonviolent struggles being very successful. But it can be much more successful than it is. But we generally, when we face a crisis, we resort to physical violence. And that is because we have gotten used to just looking at a problem until it, when it becomes a crisis. And when it becomes a crisis, then we can't find an easy solution to it, so we want to crush it and be done with it. And in that process, we destroy the person who we think represents the problem, but the problem remains unaddressed. Now, example of this is, we fought Second World War. We sacrificed nearly 70 million human lives there. We got rid of Hitler and his army and defeated them. But the philosophy of Nazism still continues to flourish and threaten us. So we didn't address that philosophy. We didn't crush that philosophy. You cannot crush a philosophy or an ideology through violence. It can only be addressed when we reach out to each other with understanding and respect and use nonviolent means to affect those ideologies.
What he's talking about here calls us back to Wednesday, and that's why I was kind of baffled by some of the comments by people who I think, Yvette Falarca, for example, who represents a California-based organization called By Any Means Necessary that advocates the use of violence when Nazis or white supremacists show up in public sphere to drive them out. And she was celebrating, for example, in a clip that we heard on Wednesday, the quote-unquote driving out of Nazis from California city streets when they were trying to petition and organize and recruit. And she said, look, we literally dragged them through the streets until they ran. We've won the day. As if they don't get to then jump online and communicate and spread these videos. And I think What I would like to ask her is, why do you think in that moment where you use violence, if that truly is effective, that's a human being who can communicate in different ways, but does that truly end fascism, Nazism, white supremacy?
Well, I don't think so. I think what they achieved there was a very simplistic and a very narrow goal. I mean, they may have gotten rid of those people who profess Nazi philosophy from their areas, dragged them out and put them away in some neighborhood. They are still there, and they're still continuing with their, negative philosophy. But they didn't get rid of the problem. They may have just pushed these people away from their areas, but the problem still persists there.
David writes to the program and says, Dorothy Day seems to me like someone who would be using the hashtag resist a lot, given her work when it came to wars. I wonder if Kate and Martha agree. I think we're talking resist. We're talking a lot of what we've seen since the November election, and this idea that you can resist, I would think, in nonviolent ways, but show some resistance to policy that you think is oppressive or hurtful to people. Is it too difficult to think think that we can understand exactly what Dorothy Day would say today? Kate, I'll start with you. Sort of the political climate, some of the tenor that talks about travel bans, immigration bans. You have a sense for what Dorothy Day might say about that?
Well, first, everything that's happened today she saw in her lifetime in one form or other. Nothing is new in this, just different expression of it. So yes, I think she has a lot to say about it. In terms of hashtag resist, well, she wasn't much into technology.
No.
She liked the telephone, but that was about it. She used a typewriter. I think resist comes in many forms. I think there's a lot of ways to do this, both in terms of activism, being on the street, being at Standing Rock. I certainly see her at Standing Rock. She had a very keen sense of the sacredness of water, and that would really have appealed to her. There are other things, I wouldn't see her at other protests, but certainly she would be out there really keeping a presence and asking that each of us do something. She said that we don't all need to follow her in her footsteps of how she resisted this whole, and it's not just one thing, discrete problems. It's this whole system that she said. Another one of her famous quotes is, all our problems stem from our acceptance of this filthy, rotten system. Now, there's some controversy about whether she actually said that, but it seems likely that she actually does sound like her, if I may say so. So there's this idea that, if we are caught in this system, we cannot get out of it. This is the world that we live in. So what are the ways in which we can step back and say, okay, I'm not going to join this. I'm not going to not respond to this. So I think she's asking each of us to figure out what we are good at, how we can respond, what do we want to do to help change things.
Okay. What do you think?
Christ tried to address the immediate suffering around him. So what does that look like in our time? And I think a very important component of the Catholic worker is that a concept of voluntary poverty. The best way to subvert the capitalist system is to reduce what you're consuming on a material level. And she also talked about war tax resistance. Stop paying for this war machine. So that's a form of resistance that is very critical to what's needed today. I mean, our economy relies on war making. Our standard of living relies on the destruction of other peoples in their lands and their countries. And so we, again, are left with how do we resist in our own hearts, our own human strivings to be comfortable, to be wealthy, to be powerful. And it's not an easy path to walk, as we see in the life of Christ. You put yourself in very dangerous positions, and you pay the price.
I want to read an email that I think is really suited to the granddaughters of Dorothy Day. Jennifer writes to the program and just says, Evan, sometimes I feel paralyzed. I'm a mother of three, trying to work a job, and I care about so many of the issues that are raised on your program, but I just don't feel like I have the time to truly devote to do the work the right way. And I wonder if your guests could address how we could get involved even if we feel limited. Well, this is an interesting question, Jennifer, because again, when I said earlier that Kate's book really humanizes Dorothy Day, maybe, you know, you hear Pope Francis invoke Dorothy Day's name, maybe you read a short capsule in the Washington Post about her, you say, she founded the Catholic Worker Movement, oh, she was this fascinating character, she cared deeply for the poor, all of these hospitality houses and the work that continues today. And maybe you think, I bet you she was this perfect mom, I bet you she was this grandmother who was always there and, you know, this one-dimensionally wonderful all the time, you know, so and it's not exactly that way. And Dorothy Day did so many things, but I wonder if Kate and Martha can tell Jennifer, who emailed the program, who feels that strain, I care about these issues, but I feel so busy, I feel paralyzed. You know, nobody's perfect here. Balance is a hard thing, as we see in your book, isn't it, Kate?
Yes, and I think we have to look in our lives as stages. I mean, Jennifer is a mother of three. That is enough. You know, say no more. It's so important. Raising children is so important. But then, you know, her children will grow up. What then can she do? Of course, that doesn't answer the immediate problems. But, getting back to the topic of nonviolence, you start with your kids. I mean, parents start with their kids. To treat them nonviolently, you know, it really starts early. I mean, that's an everyday practice. I mean, nonviolence is a practice. I also want to add, I had the honor of speaking in Charlottesville this past week, and there was two things that people really wanted me to know about what happened in Charlottesville. One is, this is a long-standing issue, and it starts with the very foundations of UVA. That university is built literally on the bones of enslaved populations. And they're still discovering these bodies. The second thing is that those riots were planned months in advance. Everyone knew that they were going to happen. And usually what happens with these kind of cases, the police tries to keep the different factions apart. And in this case, they did not. And they actually put them in an arena in which they could not get away from each other. And then when they started beating up on each other, the police did nothing. So what happened in Charlottesville could have been prevented every step of the way. It was not inevitable. So I think what happens a lot with the idea of violence versus nonviolence, we start at the end game, which is where people are beating each other up and say, well, we have to respond. Whereas, you know, never thinking about, well, what were all the steps that we took voluntarily to get us to that point.
Oh, wow. Martha, how would you respond to Jennifer's email as that parent trying to balance caring for your community, getting involved, learning the lessons of Gandhi, of Dorothy Day, but then saying, look at all, I don't have more hours in the day. I've got three kids. I've got a job. I want to be involved.
Yes. At one point, I was raising young children, working part-time and studying occupational therapy. It's huge. This sense of paralysis, this sense of shock that we hear about coming out of Charlottesville, Gandhi spoke about the means are just as important as the ends. You know, how do we get there? And in our daily lives, how do we practice nonviolence in ways that will understand what happened in the past and will carry us on into the future? And Dorothy talked about being accused of trying to cover a cancer with a Band-Aid. And so each of us has to face what we're doing in our lives. Any small thing happens. She talked about St. Teresa of Lisieux, of the Little Way. Any tiny way that we can love one another and show love to each other rather than hatred or impatience, that's a practice that we can all respond to immediately.
Jennifer, thanks for the email. And again, listeners, I'll remind you, you can email me directly. You know where to find me, WXXI. But the show email, connections@WXXI.org, connections@WXXI.org. You can call the program 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Dorothy Day and Mohandas Gandhi, The Legacy of Our Nonviolent Grandparents, is an event tonight, 7 p.m., at the Schultz Center at Nazareth College. and three grandchildren are here. Arun Gandhi, Kate Hennessy, and Martha Hennessy, Kate and Martha, granddaughters of Dorothy Day. And, well, the Gandhi name I don't have to tell you. But here we are in studio together talking about these issues, and they've come together for one night tonight. Just remarkable people with remarkable families, and we're talking about nonviolence. Jason had reached out via social media and wanted to know if our guests think that violence is justified in any circumstances. Can you think of some?
Well, certainly, I think, you know, we cannot create a totally nonviolent society. I mean, there's some violence in our everyday life, which is inevitable. When the mere fact that we walk around and crush little life forms all the time, it's a form of violence. And, you know, until we create a perfect society where we have perfect relationships with everybody, there might be need for some violence. And that could be like protection, you know, mm-hmm. if somebody comes to attack you and you want to protect yourself or somebody you love, then we ought to use some violence to protect, not excessive violence to destroy. And what we need to aim at is to reduce the violence to the bare minimum instead of keep increasing it. What we are doing today is we are increasing violence to a very great degree in our lives, and we seem to want to fight for everything in our lives. And that's not right. We should be trying to reduce the level of violence to the bare minimum.
Hannah writes to the program and says, you can let Jennifer know that there's an organization called Moms Rising, and they send you emails, things you can do from home. Sign petitions, send emails, etc. It's momsrising.org. So that comes from another mom listening in on the program. So Jennifer, if you want to check that out. I'll get your phone calls in a second. Sarah wanted to know if our guests think that Dorothy Day would be marching with Black Lives Matter. Martha Kay?
Well, the question of nonviolence, yes, and the question of self-defense. I mean, if you're brought here as a slave and you're mistreated from one generation to the next, how do you take care of yourself? And I can't speak whether Dorothy would be marching with Black Lives Matter or not, but that she certainly would understand what they were trying to achieve and accomplish. I do feel that, you know, as privileged white people, it's our onus to really step aside and let the black voices come forth. There's incredible young female black leadership in that movement today. And the question of nonviolence certainly comes up. And we all have our own practices and our own backgrounds and our own tolerances. And I think that we should be there protecting the black people who are trying to make the changes that are so desperately needed.
Okay. Kate, agree?
Yes, it's hard to know, you know, I think it's a common question, what would Dorothy do?
Our listeners have been very keen on that.
Yes, well, a lot of Catholic workers say that, what would Dorothy do? And it's hard to know. You know, she was involved with the civil rights movement from early on, and she was involved with integration in the 30s. A Catholic worker was involved from early on in integration. And so she, and they paid a price for it. I mean, there were, you know, people beating up for blacks and whites going to the beach together. I mean, it was quite extreme. So she was aware of that problem from the very beginning, and it was very important for her to have black voices in the Catholic Worker newspaper. Other than that, you know, I can't say.
Okay. And Arun, I think as you certainly know, especially in the last decade, there are certain things that can be taken out of context or sort of misunderstood. And, you know, some of our listeners have shared the comment that you made to The Nation, that as long as we point fingers at somebody else without realizing that there are fingers pointing back at us, we aren't going to dissolve any issues, when you were asked about Black Lives Matter. But I don't know if you feel that that's taken out of context, or what more would you say about the movement and the success of the movement?
Well, I think certainly, you know, they have a right to protest. What I don't like about their right is the aggressiveness, the passive violence that they show. And
what do you mean by passive violence?
Well, the anger and the frustration. Mm-hmm. And you know, there's a wonderful story, and not a story, but an example. In 1913, when my grandfather decided to leave South Africa, before he left, he decided to launch one final campaign against prejudice in South Africa. And like he always did, he made everything public. He, you know, what he was going to do, where, why, and so on. And after making that public announcement, the next day, the workers of the South African railways decided to go on a strike for better working conditions. And strike is a nonviolent weapon. But when grandfather heard this and read this in the newspapers, he decided that he didn't want to burden the government with his own problems. So he said, I'm going to withdraw my campaign and let the government deal with the strike. And then after that, I will do my thing. The strike leaders came to him and said, look, we are fighting the same enemy. Why don't you join us and we can strengthen ourselves and fight the enemy? And grandfather's response was that, first of all, I don't have an enemy. I am trying to change the attitudes of a friend. They are not my enemies. And secondly, he says, you have a different agenda. I have a different agenda. So you go ahead and do what you have to do, and then I will do what I have to do. Well, the strike went on, and they came out with all that anger and frustration and, you know, typically like strikers do. So it was very easy for the establishment to create an incident so that they could justify crushing them with police force. And that's what happened. Within 4 or 5 days, that strike was crushed. Everybody had to go back to work without gaining anything at all. When grandfather launched his campaign after that, he filled the prisons, but there was no anger, no frustration, no fisting showing, or no, retaliation in any way, physical or passive. They were very quiet, but they came out in large numbers and filled the prisons. And weeks after this campaign started, the Prime Minister, General Smuts, invited grandfather to his office to sign an agreement. And at that time, he confessed to grandfather and he said, I could crush the strikers because there was so much anger there that I could exploit that anger and crush them. But I don't know how to crush you. You show so much compassion and understanding and respect for us. I don't know how to crush you. And that is the key.
That's what you see, a parallel or a lesson for Black Lives Matter.
Exactly. Hmm.
Okay. I want to thank our guests for being here. And Michael and Rush, we're hitting the end and we're out of time, but this is a great chance that if you didn't get through this hour, to go tonight. And Harry Murray, I would just ask you, and by the way, Harry, one of your former students jumped on Twitter to say, such a privilege to have had you in class. And Danielle says, grateful to have been a student of Dr. Murray. So you have plenty of fans.
Thanks,
too. There you go. Tonight, 7 p.m., why don't you remind our listeners, 30 seconds, what's coming up tonight?
Okay. Tonight, a panel with the grandchildren of Dorothy Day and Mohandas Gandhi on the nonviolent legacy of our grandparents at the Schultz Center, Nazareth College, free and open to the public, and there will be a book signing by both Arun and Kate afterwards.
All right, that is tonight. And they've written books on their remarkable grandparents, children's books, books for adults, all kinds of themes. But you've heard so much this hour on nonviolence, and that discussion continues tonight. And I just want to thank you. Thank you for organizing, and thank you for being here, Harry. It's been great having you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much to all three of you for the work that you've done, for the wisdom and insight that you share, the work of your families, and the work that continues. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Greatly appreciate it. We're going to get a short break, and much more Connections is coming up on this Friday afternoon.